Greetings, everyone. Very good to be back. First of all, it's good to be alive. And secondly, it is good to be uninjured. And thirdly, it is good to be in good health and to feel good. The little island nation of Jamaica, which lies south of Cuba in the Caribbean and has a population of just over 2.5 million, has been virtually wiped out. Out of 500,000 homes in the land, over 150,000 are totally destroyed, and the entirety of the remainder are damaged. I have some of the recollections here that I was scribbling down when I went back and forth to my room on the 10th floor of the hotel in Kingston, as that hurricane came directly over the island, and of course we endured it for the better part of a full day, but the effects of the winds that built toward the hurricane could be felt from the night before all the way through until dawn, when it actually touched the northern part of the island, until way beyond the following dawn. So it is something that you don't go through very, very quickly. It goes on hour after hour after hour. I jotted those things down as they occurred, so what I'm going to do is to depart from my usual formula and to give you some of my impressions and feelings. But first of all, a little reminder from the Word of God that perhaps would be good, so that we can refresh our minds about His power and about just how great is the eternal Creator God. The book of Job is a study in the self-righteousness of one man who thought he knew about God, who could make notes about the eternal, and who could philosophize and meditate and argue and continually discuss all about God and demons and angels and good and bad and righteousness and sin. And he was a man of great wisdom, of great acumen, of great experience. But when his own home was destroyed, when his family was wiped out, when his cattle were taken from him, he could not see what his greatest problem really was. And so when you read the entirety of the book of Job, all the way up to the point where Elihu finally began to talk after he was totally disgusted with Job's three friends and with Job himself, it's quite a study, because without you realizing it, you may too be taken in by many of the arguments of some of the other gentlemen who tried to find and tell Job what was really wrong with him. Elihu hit upon it when he said in chapter 35 and verse 2, "Do you think this to be right, that you said, 'My righteousness is more than God's'? For you said, 'What advantage will it be unto thee, and what profit shall I have if I be cleansed from my sin?'" Elihu continually pointed out to Job the power of God by pointing to the things that God had made. He said, for example, verse 27 of the 36th chapter, "He makes small the drops of water. They pour down rain according to the vapor thereof, which the clouds do drop and distill upon man abundantly. Also, can any understand the spreadings of the clouds or the noise of his tabernacle? Behold, he stretches his light upon it and covers the bottom of the sea. For by them judges he the people. He gives meat in abundance," meaning from the sea and the land. "With clouds he covereth the light, and commands it not to shine by the cloud that comes between. The noise thereof shows concerning it the cattle, also concerning the rain that goes up, or the mist that goes up, the vapor," as it reads. At this, that is, as his thoughts take in all of nature, the weather patterns, the fantastic power of God, "my heart trembles and is moved out of his place. Hear attentively the voice," or the noise of his voice, "and the sound that goes out of his mouth." You've heard thunder. You've heard it very close, probably a lightning strike nearby your home, where there is practically an instantaneous crackling noise rather than a flash to be followed by a distant rumbling. And there's a very great difference in the two. But unless you have been immediately beneath or near a tornado, or have been in a building suffering the onslaught of winds up to 120 miles an hour, you probably have not heard a voice like thunder, and the voice that might be equated to the sound, as it says in Acts the second chapter, of a mighty rushing wind. Now I know what it sounded like on the day of Pentecost. A mighty rushing wind that just takes your breath and that boggles your mind, that makes you feel like a small little bug that wants to crawl under something very, very solid and find a place to hide. After it, a voice roars. He thunders with the voice of His excellency, and He will not stay them when His voice is heard. God thunders marvelously with His voice. Great things doeth He, which we cannot comprehend. Then He talks of the snow and of beasts and creatures, and says in verse 9, out of the south cometh the whirlwind. Well, a whirlwind was like a tornado. But a tornado is merely a very tight, small, little, localized storm that is a microcosm of a hurricane. A hurricane is a monster tornado that can extend for more than 700-800 miles, 350 or 400 miles out in all directions from an eye that can be 8, 10, 12 miles across. And all of the feeder clouds that come into that giant low-pressure section are causing air to rush with cyclonic fury across the surface of the land, trying to feed that near vacuum of a terrible low-pressure area, which is just sucking the wind, drawing it toward it from hundreds of miles away. And each feeder cloud has its own cyclonic storms because of the moisture that is sucked up from the hot, tepid waters of the Caribbean or the Gulf. Tropic waters condense into foggy clouds, and then, of course, comes down in blinding sheets of rain. So that, as we know this morning, we were watching CNN, the tornadoes, over 20 of them, were sighted right up here in San Antonio, Texas, and have already begun to do great damage. Several mobile homes were swept away. Some apartment complexes and homes were totally destroyed or damaged. Cars are smashed. Trees and power lights are down. People are in shelters, and some are without homes. Just as a result of one local cloud hundreds of miles away from the center of this gigantic storm. I've had a very great privilege, I think. If I had it to do over again, I might pause for a moment and wonder whether I should. But on reflection, I probably would. I would probably go again. If I had never been in a hurricane before, and if I knew that I would be standing here safe before you to tell you that it's been my privilege to be beneath the very eye, walking outdoors, looking up at the sunshine for about 40 minutes as an 8-mile-wide eye of that hurricane went over us in the midst of the greatest storm in this century to come out of the Atlantic and into the Gulf that broke every record, that is the lowest pressure system ever on record, lower than the one I looked up in my encyclopedia this morning, having broken all records involving hurricanes. I probably would do it again. Let me first of all give you some impressions from my point of view where I was. We were in the Wyndham Hotel, which is a 15-story building. Right next to it in Kingston is a government building, and beyond it is another very high-rise hotel called the Pegasus. New Kingston is just a part of a city that is laid out around a bay with a long, narrow sand spit or an isthmus that protects the bay, and on the end of that isthmus is the runway of the International Airport at Kingston. Immediately around Kingston is a spine of a large mountain system. The island was over 100 miles long. I'll give you a little bit of statistical information on it right quickly, because I want you brethren in the United States to know a little bit more about Jamaica and about your brethren and the church down there. Population of that nation is about 2,366,000, I should say. About 2.5 million approximately, because that was a 1985 statistic. It is 4,232 square miles, or slightly smaller than the state of Connecticut. You know, the nearest neighbor is Cuba on the north, and just straight east of it is, of course, Haiti and the Dominican Republic, one great big island. And, of course, the hurricane came right by the southern part of that island. Immediately out to the west of it is Grand Cayman, a very small island, very, very low-lying, very flat, which has been absolutely wiped out, utterly devastated. The country is four-fifths covered by mountains. Kingston's population is estimated as 100,000. St. Andrews is bigger with 393,000. The chief economies down there are, I should say, industries involving the economy are rum, molasses, cement, paper, sugar cane, coffee, bananas, coconuts, and citrus. The coconut industry is 100% destroyed. I doubt if there is a single coconut tree standing on the island of Jamaica. The banana industry, together between them, hiring thousands of people and representing tens of millions of dollars annually, is utterly wiped out. There's not a single banana tree standing. Coffee, wiped out. Probably every agricultural crop wiped out. No doubt cattle have been killed. Human life was remarkably saved, I think perhaps in the teens, somewhere eventually, maybe as many as 40 because of the number that are declared missing, but human life actually was not one of the major costs. The cost is going to be felt, of course, literally for many, many years to come, not just for a few months. And as we stand here today, I tried to call Ian Boyne from my home this morning. The lines are still down. For 4 days, of course, we could not get through from our hotel even to the airport. Nor could the airport office downtown call its airport desk from the office in downtown because the local the lines were simply down and no one could get through. The mountain roads that go up to Negril and across the mountains to Ocho Rios and Montego Bay, which are the most popular resort areas known to Americans, were washed out because of the floods that damaged bridges and eroded the roads, so there was not even any vehicular connection or communication between the cities up on the north coast to those down on the south. The hotel in which I stayed, 15 stories tall, in one main high-rise section, a big pool around which was an L-shaped two-story cabana, a series of many, many hotel rooms, and then a very large ballroom, convention center, and other meeting rooms out from under the high-rise segment. I was on the 10th floor facing toward the west, and Bronson James was right beside me, 1003 and 1005. A year ago in February, when we were down there, we were on the 15th floor, and the restaurants are up there, as well as a small VIP room where they have breakfast served in the morning for people on that floor, and I'll tell you more about that a little bit later on. When we got there on Sunday afternoon, it was to be met by Mr. Ian Boyne and his wife and Mr. and Mrs. Herschel Fisher, whom for some reason they've nicknamed Paul Fisher and his wife, and some other brethren, and of course Doug McClure, who is very wonderful to give us the use of his automobile and took us, instead of having to wait for a taxi or something, in his car on into the hotel. And that night, of course, the wind was already beginning to gust and was blowing up to around 20, 25 miles an hour. But we went out to a nearby hotel, an older colonial-style building, very charming. We had it entirely to ourselves because the hurricane warning was out, and I imagine most people were staying home. But we had a delightful dinner that evening with all of the brethren down there, and, of course, we're looking forward to the Feast of Trumpets the next morning, hoping against hope that that thing would do as it has always done, all hurricanes since 1951, and perhaps blow itself out on the mountains of Haiti, or perhaps turn north between Haiti and go on up toward Cuba, or perhaps just go back where it came from, because they're completely capricious, and you cannot always totally tell exactly where they're going to go, no matter all of the tracking systems they have and the computer images that they can display. They can be quite capricious, as was proved back in the late 1960s or early 70s, I forget when it was, that hurricane was headed toward Florida when we were observing the Feast of Tabernacles at Jekyll Island under a tent, and instead went back and forth across Cuba and utterly devastated that island nation and left hundreds of thousands homeless and only affected Florida with high winds and an awful lot of rain. So they can do practically anything, and for some reason, because I had seen that happen before, I guess I just didn't think God was going to allow it. I thought, well, we're down here for the Feast of Trumpets. We're going to have a large special church visit. Maybe we'll get a part of it. Maybe the edge of it will brush by. But certainly, it will not hit us directly. Little did I know. By that night and the next morning, television news was that it was still headed directly toward, and it was only about 100 miles away and was moving at about 10 miles an hour. Or 12 miles an hour, and was expected to hit the tip of the island of Jamaica, and was suspected or supposed to make landfall by about the dawn. Well, all through that night, I was awake a lot of the time, because at both ends of the hallway, where the narrow windows were, each little window has tiny cracks and crevices, of course, and the wind sets up its own discordant howl, so that you have low notes and high notes, a shriek, a wail, a moan, which increase or decrease with the intensity of the wind. And between them all, it sounded like a whole pound full of cats and dogs going, wow, wow, all night long. And so my window and the windows at the hallway and the elevator shafts and the roof and everything were just keeping me awake. And I many times padded to my window and looked out, and I could see the trees in the lights down below, kind of bending over, and I knew the wind was blowing and getting more and more in intensity, 30, 40 miles an hour through the night. Well, by the morning, it was reaching up to around 50 miles an hour, And with gray dawn, I could look out and see sheets of rain beginning to fall, and the trees were bending way over, and of course all the electrical lines were dancing, and the sound in my window was even louder than before. We went down and found that the normal breakfast area, which would have been on the veranda, had been hastily moved inside. That all the pool furniture and the canopies and the beautiful umbrellas and the plastic chairs and tables had been tossed into the pool to protect it, because otherwise it would be picked up and blown right into the window. And that they had done everything they could to prepare the hotel. There were men with tapes that were running around taping up all the windows, and we got a piece of tape, and Bronson and I went back up to the room, and we taped our windows just every nice geometrical pattern we could think of. And because Bronson's window was beginning to move a little bit on the molding at the lower part, we took two of the chairs and wedged them underneath that. And that done, we thought we can last the morning better downstairs. So we went back downstairs, and by this time the rain was beginning to get horizontal, and the wind was getting more and more powerful and picking up around 10:30 in the morning. It got so fantastically powerful that we thought, surely it's almost over, but it was just the beginning. And it went on hour after hour. And finally, we were beginning to see boards, signs, large pieces of metal blowing by, large shrubs, portions of trees and tree limbs outside. And you begin to hear groaning, cracking, snapping sounds, and you realize that here and there, asphalt shingles and other debris are being picked up and hurtled against windows somewhere. You hear a ripping, tearing sound. You don't know where it came from. And there were probably 85 to 100 people in the hotel, and they were all huddled in the sort of an upper lobby or the lower lobby. There was a two-split-level lobby, and then you went down to an area that was just a flat roof to the ballroom area, as I said, and that roof began to blow off. So all of the people who were there got down on the floor behind a very large concrete pylon, like a portion of the building structure, right inside the lounge next to a piano. They turned up chairs on its side and got on the floor and huddled up against the concrete. And I was just standing there by the concrete and looking at all of this, and I thought, well, I'm going to run up and see if my window is broken out. So I walked up the 10 floors. The elevators, long since, of course, had quit working. The emergency power was now on, but of course I was sitting there when the television set went out and the lights went off and all the power went off because the lines were being blown down. So I walked up and I looked, and sure enough the window was still intact, and as I walked to my closet I had moved my suitcase into the bathroom and closed the door because I thought if the window goes in I want to save as many of my clothes as I can. I looked at my suits hanging in the closet and I felt kind of nauseous, like I was beginning to fall, and I thought, what am I doing? Getting dizzy here. And I looked at my suits, and they were gently swinging about 3 or 4 inches like this. And I realized the building was swaying on the 10th floor. And I said, I'm going back downstairs, and I'm going to get out from underneath the high-rise part of this building and go over underneath a lower roof, which I promptly did. Because it entered my mind, I'm not sure about the engineering of some of these older buildings. I know what happened in Mexico City at that earthquake some few years ago, and perhaps that kind of stress of 100 miles an hour on the side of that building could actually cause something to let go, and then all the floors just collapse with all the concrete on top of each other. That was the one moment, I would say, when I stood there looking at my suit swinging, when I had one brief moment's wonderment as to whether or not I might get physically hurt. By the time I got down that stairwell, having already counted the stairs, I tend to do that automatically when I go to a hotel or something. I don't know why I always count the number of stairs. I guess I read it in a mystery novel when I was a young kid. So I knew there were 14 to each landing, so even though it's pitch black and you can't see a thing, I'm just counting 14 hanging on the rail and going around the corners. I get back down. And about that time, the window in the office over beyond us blew in, and here came furniture, lamps, IBM printouts, business cards, all the stuff off the desks and out of the drawers, blasted into the lobby, along with an awful lot of shattered glass and everything. And there was an alcove about as big as this room over there, but just filled with debris. Well, one of the American ladies went clear over the brink at this point and began shrieking and screaming, and her eyes rolled back. She nearly passed out. There was someone who had had medical teaching, maybe he was a doctor, but they picked her up and carried her into the ballroom around the corner, and they found some mattresses and put her down and were putting cold compresses on her forehead, and she was clear out of it for a little while. She was the only one that went over the brink just out of nothing but fear and went into shock. But everyone at that point moved down into the hallway by the ballroom to get away from the worst part of the storm. And the roofs began to leak, and then cascading water began to come in on the carpet and on the lobby terrazzo. And they put cans, but you would actually have to walk by seeing where the drops were, and quickly the water got almost to your shoe tops, so you would wade through it when you wanted to go to the restroom or back up to the concrete pillar to hide behind it or into the ballroom or somewhere. I went into the restroom and I heard this sound and looked up, and of course all of these acoustical tiles, just like these with a low ceiling, had long since sagged, fallen through, and water was just dripping down real rapidly and hitting it. And as it all let go in the lobby area, people would then step on the tiles and they'd very quickly get reduced to something that looked the consistency of oatmeal or cornmeal mush. And there was just water everywhere, like actually the fire department was up there spraying water through the ceiling in the hotel. I didn't know at that time, until I looked out a little later on, that the entire 15th floor where we had stayed the year before was gone, and that the windows had broken, that the furniture was simply blown out the other side, and the windows on both sides were blown out, and the entire floor was utterly gutted, as had also occurred to the 6th floor. All the 6th floor windows let go, not all of them, but some of them, which then blew the doors off the hinges and totally soaked the entire area. So that was most of the damage, until the roof let go, that two-story L-shaped cabana unit out by the pool, and blew off. So all those got soaked and ruined, and probably about 40 or 50 rooms were destroyed in that area. There were some huge, great, twisting, lovely trees right outside a pleasant veranda overlooking the pool where we ate breakfast a year ago. The trees were twisted, snapped off, turned upside down, and thrown all over the pool area. Even bushes that tall were bent clear to the ground. Tiny little trees like this one were bent over, and most of these leaves were gone, and the few that remained were in little strips, just shredded by the wind. There were some big umbrellas that were supported by a huge piece of concrete about 2.5 feet in diameter by about 2 feet high, with a standpipe that came up out of it, into which the pole of the umbrella fit. When Bronson and I walked out during the eye, we looked at those things. We were talking about the weight of them, and we tried to kick one over when we picked it back up because they're lying on their side. And we began to realize that these things had been blown over by the force of the hurricane, that even a pipe that high and about 60 or 70 pounds of concrete was not able to stand under the force of that wind in the pool area. And it was just mind-bending to see the twisted trunks, the limbs snapped off, the bushes shredded, the hotels, glass everywhere. If you'd been standing in the street, you, of course, could have had your head cut right off or very deep wounds, because glass was flying everywhere. How glass got all over my carpet, I'll never know. I don't think there was a crack that big beneath my doorway to the little balcony. Yet there were little shards of glass all over my carpet. And it had to be coming across the top of the hotel from other windows blowing out in adjacent buildings, then the down blast catch it, suck it back into the balcony, and then the vacuum created by low pressure inside the hotel, which storms tend to create, somehow sucked little pieces of glass in underneath that tiny crack and got them inside my room on the floor. And I'll never know how exactly, but I think that explains it. When the eye finally got there, it was obvious, because in only moments the wind quit. And it looked just like it does here outside. Sunshine, clouds swirling around, but not any wind at all. Very quiet. I walked outside around the hotel, walked out in the front. The canopy had been blown off. There were huge, big iron bars over which canvas had been stretched, which was just like a sail, and they were anchored in concrete, but it had twisted them and eventually twisted them so violently it just broke it off, and one piece of it was going wham, wham against cars parked in the parking lot and beating up some of the cars. And here were some of the people standing out there on the sidewalk, and Bronson had gone out and was talking to them, and you could see the wall cloud off over the harbor slowly coming closer. So we knew that the eye was right over us and was slowly moving to the northwest, and that only a few more minutes we were going to get the brunt of it all over again. But little did I know that the backside of that eye was going to be far more powerful and far more frightening than the front side of it. And this time we simply moved to the other side of the hotel and got ready for about another 5 hours of it, when you're already so weary and the back of your neck is tense, and your body feels like somebody has been beating on you with a baseball bat. Your mind cannot comprehend anymore. You don't hear too well because your ears are filled with a shrieking sound that you'll never get rid of, and here it comes all over again. Well, when the second part of that storm began to hit, it got blacker outside than it had before. It got so dark, and finally the rain was so heavy, that though I was standing on the opposite side of the hotel near a narrow little window, visibility got to the point I could barely see, once in a while, a dim shape of a building across a narrow street. Visibility was down to less than 40 yards. And, blowing by, were all kinds of bits and pieces of debris. Finally, one of the hotel security men came over and put his hands on the narrow window, and we could feel it bulging in, so he motioned to me to get back. And then I walked over and saw quite a phenomenon. In the hallway, entering into the ballroom, was an old, battered piano. And there, sitting at the piano, with his back turned to the storm, as if he didn't want to even look at it, was Bronson James, playing the simple tunes that he knew, trying to calm everybody, give a little bit of music into the environment. So I sat down beside him, and we began to hum a couple of tunes and sing a little bit. And I think it was a little calming, you know, just to have something that seemed to be reasonable and sensible in the midst of this utter chaos that was going on outside. These are the notes that I wrote right while this was all happening. Yes, this reminds me of something. We had walked into the area just after the office had blown all the stuff through portions of the lobby, and Bronson was standing there at about the time one of the tiles let go and a lot of the acoustical debris came raining down. I said, "Look out." Bronson dodged real quick, but a whole bunch of it hit him on the head. It was real lightweight stuff, and he just brushed it out of his hair. But it did scare him for a minute because I looked up and said, "Look out." He didn't know what was coming, but he got hit just by powdery things that had come from the ceiling. I wrote here, aftermath, wind howled all night. Well, that's the next page. I'm getting ahead of myself here. Oh, yeah, well, I've talked about windows, signs, electric poles, but I made myself a note here. When I looked out the older part of the hotel, there were a pair of tennis courts, and beside it a great, huge concrete and brick wall on which were painted handball markings. And they lay flat on the ground with a sort of an undulating pattern to what had been the handball markings, almost like the sidewalk down at Rio de Janeiro. And I remembered to write that down. The electrical poles were lying over, and the roofs were largely either ripped up or some portions of them gone on some of the buildings across the street. I remember seeing lampposts around the pool where the outdoor lighting had ripped the mushroom-type lampshade off, and they were simply dangling by some wires, and wrote that down. Of course, there were no lights, no communication, and so all during that night, we were provided with candles, and it was very, very steamy and very sticky. You couldn't even get under the sheet, so you simply lay on top of the bed and got up every now and then. But at no time did we have any absence of water. We always had water running in the showers, and the first day or so there was hot water, and it finally got kind of tepid, but there was hot water, running water, so we had no complaint that way, although I didn't want to drink the water because I didn't know how much of it might be contaminated a little later on. And it was very difficult to sleep that night because the wind howled all night, even though the storm was already on the other end of the island and was gradually heading toward Grand Cayman. And I said at 9:30 the next morning, got very dark outside. There was a huge thunderstorm that came along with torrential rain, violent winds, instant flooding, and the roar of rain on the metal roofs across the street. Big cascades of water soaked. So as you walked on the thick carpets like this carpet here, you heard a squishing noise and a white foam came up and kind of covered the tops of your shoes. I think that's enough of the way I experienced the hurricane where I was. Remarkably, the next day, near midday, here came Mr. and Mrs. Fisher and Mr. Ian Boyne came to the hotel. I guess the Fishers had walked. They had a smile on their face. She was barefoot. He was dressed, obviously, in work clothes. I said, "Well, how did you make out?" First of all, they wanted to know how we were. They were very relieved to see that we were fine. I said, "We're fine. We don't have any complaints." And we didn't. I don't care what kind of conditions. If I'd had a crust of bread and one glass of warm water every day, you wouldn't have heard one complaint out of my mouth if I'd have still been there for 2 weeks. You'd have never heard me complain. I'll just guarantee you that. So we were asking, well, how are you? What happened? She smiled and she looked at us. She said, we lost our roof, with a big smile. Their roof. The roof had been ripped right off their house while they were in it. One portion of their roof, apparently, in the bedroom, had been spared. So they had hurriedly tried to move everything they could into the driest area. She still was able to cook. I don't know if they have a gas stove, but it certainly could not have been electrical. Or maybe a wood-burning stove. I just don't know, and I forgot to ask. But knowing that her refrigerator was gone, she immediately got all of her perishable meats and cooked it. And so he, in the day that ensued, was out trying to pick up the pieces of his roof, and he managed to find all of them scattered next door to that, around the area, and lugged them back to the house. And they were very cheerful because the next day they were saying, she was laughing about it, that he had been up there all day hammering and putting that zinc metal corrugated roof back on their house. But they didn't have any putty. So she got some flour and made a thick paste and handed him the batter, and he was using flour to put like putty in the cracks in their roof. And she began to laugh and said that she and her neighbor lady, whom she'd taken in because her house was destroyed, and she had a neighbor lady moving in to sleep with what shelter she could give her, saw the nails coming through in a line, and she said she didn't have the heart to call up to him and say, Herschel, you're missing the joist. You're just pounding the nails through the metal in the wrong place. But he was up there working away. And the amazing thing to me was that those people could still smile and they could still laugh. Now let me give you the ultimate in my story. When they showed up on the day after the hurricane, they came to Bronson's room bearing gifts. She put on the bed a clock made out of beautiful wood, some jars of jelly, and two cartons of Blue Mountain famous Jamaican coffee in little tiny burlap sacks, and said that these were gifts from the church people to Charlie and to Benny and to Ron and to me and to Mrs. Armstrong and so on. I said 10 times, I guess, that I was embarrassed. I said, I am ashamed and embarrassed. And I urged her to take that stuff back, and I said, you have far greater need of it. She absolutely refused to do so. No, it's from all the church brethren. And we want this to express our appreciation to you for coming down here, and so on. And she had these jars of famous Jamaican jam that you see in the stores in the airport that you can buy as a souvenir of Jamaica. And the little burlap bags of Blue Mountain coffee, for which they're quite famous. And I imagine there won't be any Blue Mountain coffee for quite a while. I was really overcome by that, by the fact that this woman who had lost her roof, had all of her furniture and clothing drenched and soaked, was instead walking all of those miles over to that hotel to give us a gift. Well, we began to walk out and about the hotel a little bit, even though we'd heard that widespread looting had begun to occur, that the army had been called out and they were quite visible, walking about with M16s on their back, that an absolute curfew was established from 7 p.m. until 6 a.m., and anyone caught out after dark was to be shot. The government declared emergency martial law and simply said, if you're outside, you will be shot. Two people were. Mrs. Fisher told of a story when she was on the way to the hotel that day of a man who was carrying away a stove on his head who had broken into a store somewhere. And unfortunately, in any society, including ours, as you well know, in an airline's disaster, people will actually go to the bodies and begin to search them for jewelry and wallets. It's happened time and again. And when other people are suffering, there are always those about who will prey upon them and take an opportunity for a complete breakdown of all of your normal infrastructure of a very vulnerable and a very technologically developed society, of things like electrical and water lines and bus lines and things like that. When they're all disrupted and you can't get in a call to the police or a call to the fire department, there's no water pressure, there's no way to communicate with anyone, then people think of looting. So I imagine the curfew is still on every night down in Jamaica right now. What I want to suggest is, because of the scripture I want to turn to now in the book of Romans, the 12th chapter, before I tell you a little more about this and read to you a couple of excerpts from the very hurriedly and very brief edition of the Daily Gleaner, which is the paper for which Ian Boyne works, that was out on the day after the hurricane in Jamaica that said 40 billion Jamaican dollars needed for recovery, or 8 billion American dollars, and that's probably a very conservative estimate. In the 12th chapter of the book of Romans, it talks about our ministry. It says that we're many members in one body, verse 4, and that we're all different. We don't have the same office. And so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and every one members one of another. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith, or ministry, let us wait on our ministering, or he that teaches on teaching, so that the teacher isn't frustrated because he can't be a prophet, and the prophet is not frustrated because he is not a teacher, or he that exhorts on exhortation, and he does so with alacrity and simplicity and generosity. He that giveth, let him do so with liberality or simplicity. What is your gift? Let's read the rest of them. He that rules, if he is given a certain responsibility, he's over a committee, he has some responsibility involving a church, maybe he's a deacon, whatever, with diligence. He that shows mercy, with cheerfulness. Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor, preferring one another. Not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation. You'll learn that very quickly when there is nothing else to do but sit there, grin, and bear it. You develop a great deal of inner patience. I would have been waiting yet had I not been able to get out of there, and I would not have complained. Continuing instant in prayer, distributing to the necessity of saints. That is a command from our Creator God. And I want to here announce to all of the tape program, to all of our ministry, and to all the other local churches, as I announce here to you in Tyler, that our people in Jamaica, their cousins, uncles, and brothers, their near neighbors and friends, and in fact all of the entire populace of Jamaica, is in desperate need of whatever help we can give. Today I called around the country several places. I called Federal Express. There is no reason to talk to them. They will not ship the type of things we have in mind. But I finally got through to two Air Force bases, and they sent me to the MAC Squadron Military Air Command up in Illinois. And I talked to their chief up there, who patched me through while I was on the telephone to Washington, D.C., and put me in charge with the Emergency Relief Section of the State Department. And I let them know of my desire and of what I want to announce to you today. I want to announce that we need immediately in all of our churches to take up two kinds of collections. First, financial, and secondly, material. The most immediate need we cannot provide, because we cannot send food down there, probably because we would be constrained by the difficulty in shipping it unless it would be canned, preserved, or dried. We can certainly send clothing, but that is not the most immediate need, because even though clothing is soaked and drenched and bedraggled and dirty, it can be salvaged and can be worn. If you want to send clothing, by all means go ahead and do so. If you want to send canned or dried food, staples like corn, wheat in cans, of the hydrogen-packed staples like beans and so on, by all means, do so. But as I discussed this with a lady at the Emergency Relief Center in the State Department in Washington, D.C., she said she would consider the longer-term needs. First of all, I want to get a hold of Ian Boyne and ask him to take a survey of all of our brethren down there and find out exactly what is it they need the worst. And I would expect it is building materials. Lumber, plywood, tools, nails, sheeting for roofs, insulation, things of that nature that we might not ever think of. They may need things like lanterns. They may need flashlights and batteries. They may need maybe emergency generators, like the little gasoline-driven Hondas that you can plug in electric light bulbs to. They may need survival-type equipment. I don't really know what it is. But I know that in my case, about every year, I like to call Goodwill and prepare a box and empty out a lot of clothing that I no longer need. Seasonal clothing, clothing that I've worn out, clothing that I'm not wearing, and get rid of it. And I would say that if we have things like that, and not only just old things we're tired of, we want to get rid of, but perhaps even good things, maybe even new things, that we might want to consider the need of some of those people down there. And let's find out exactly what is the need and not send things that are not needed, but find out exactly what it is. And I'll try to let you know by verbal communication at the Feast of Tabernacles and or in a letter or in the tape program as soon as I myself can find out. I tried to get through to Ian Boyne all morning, not all morning, but several times, and we simply get this recording that is what my wife got when she tried to get through to me. The lines are still down. There was no telephonic communication even between the city and the airport or between Kingston and St. Andrews or Kingston and Montego Bay or Kingston and Ocho Rios. However, some of the roads began to be open and people began to get through, and of course there were helicopters operating back and forth across the island, and some of the airlines, including Jamaica Airlines, were landing at Montego Bay and picking up passengers and then coming to the airport at Kingston and then taking tourists back out of there. So by that means, and talking to tourists who had been there, we learned that the hotel, which Mr. Ian Boyne had reserved for the Feast of Tabernacles, escaped unscathed in Ocho Rios in Jamaica. What many American tourists are going to immediately do is cancel all of their plans to go to those resort communities at Montego Bay and Ocho Rios in Jamaica. You can understand why they would do that, because they would be afraid that services would be interrupted, that there wouldn't be food or suitable water, that all the fun would go out of it because everything has been devastated and wiped out. It isn't that bad. You can drive from downtown Kingston to the airport, and you see the buildings just like before. But if you look close, there's a black hole here and one there and three down here, which means those windows were broken out and the rain came in and soaked those floors, but probably 80-90% of that building looks just like it did before the storm. So when I say the hotel in which our people are going to spend the feast is unscathed, I mean exactly what I say. It was not damaged at all. I understand Mr. and Mrs. Frank Morang up in Kansas are planning to go down there for the Feast of Tabernacles, but he was the only minister who was planning on going. So I'm going to suggest something that might sound very strange to you. If you want to have the experience of a lifetime, if you want to get to know some converted people, that would really be a tremendous experience for you. If there are some people who would like to change their plans and go to Jamaica and be there for the Feast of Tabernacles, you'll probably have the most wondrous, the most memorable, the most spiritual, and the most rewarding Feast of Tabernacles you have ever had. So if there are any people out there that hear this on the tape program or in other church services around the country who would like to be a little more intrepid, have a little bit of the pioneering spirit, I have just come from there and can tell you I would go back tomorrow if there were any critical need and I felt that I could do some particular good and didn't have the feast facing me and my commitment to all of the people in this country. They will be well provided for at the Feast of Tabernacles in terms of what those people can do to help one another, and I'm sure they will go on with their plans as just before. We were not able to hear of every member of the church so far as how their homes survived. I'm sure some of them were wiped out. The walls were blown down as well as the roof blown off. Ian Boyne's roof is intact. His home is intact. All of the roofs on his neighbors on each side were blown off. But many of those roofs are just joists or tubifores and then tin, which is nailed down, just like over here in East Texas, a lot of tin roofs you see. And so if the tin is just buckled and torn, but is maybe next door, they can go get it, and they can hammer it out straight, and they can put it back. And many of them have been doing just that for the last several days and working tirelessly to try to dig out from all of the rubble. I was amazed at how the American government began to immediately react, and the C-130 and several more began to come in, and at least they were wise enough to know, and they studied this type of thing for many, many years, so they know exactly what some of the emergency needs are. And they bring in things like chainsaws and axes and cots and blankets and medical supplies, and they bring in things to provide shelter, like they brought in thousands of feet of canvas and plastic. And immediately thought of that, and I thought, isn't that fantastic that they're geared up for that? They have these things stored, and the Air Force was able to get them aboard C-130s and bring them in so they can spread plastic sheeting over the tops of buildings to get things in out of the rain. And everywhere you begin to hear the sound of chainsaws, and people were out on the streets and sawing trees that were leaning across power poles. They immediately got into the pool area where all of the trees had been torn up and were cutting them up and piling them in neat sections so they could become fuel for firewood. And I was amazed at how quickly they began to clean up the terrible mess that they had seen. So as I made these telephone calls and learned what I did this morning, I still have some more calling around to do. I want to call Eastern and Jamaican Airlines. I want to call the Jamaican Embassy. And eventually I want to get in touch again with Mr. Ian Boyne and find out what are their long-term needs. That's why I think that financial assistance is the most direct form of assistance we can give them. First of all, because if building supplies are going to be available, and they will be, because all the lumber companies and all the people involved in shipping those basic materials like tubifores and all kinds of lumber and like plywood, you can believe me, are going to know that there will be a tremendous need for it, so it's going to be there. So A, we want to find out, is it obtainable in Jamaica and can it be purchased? And B, is there any need for us to think of things like actually purchasing it and seeing if we can ship it down from the United States? But certainly, I think that the Church of God International needs to show itself not only obedient to the laws of God and the teaching of Jesus Christ, but simply, as it says here, dearly beloved and fellow saints with people who have a spirit, who have an attitude in great adversity, of such love and giving that it makes me feel very small and very ashamed of some of the wonderful things that God has given me. I'll conclude my remarks by telling you what it was like when we left. Here they came in the early morning, Mr. Ian Boyne getting there at about a quarter till 6 o'clock. We got up before 5 o'clock and were ready to go to the airport because we'd gotten word that if we just went over there and stood in line, we might be able to get out. Well, we got there, and here was a long line already formed going up to the Eastern counter before anybody from Eastern Airlines had even arrived. It was dark, and the airport was largely empty, but there was a long line of people standing around with their baggage. Bronson and I took our place in line with Mr. Ian Boyne and one of the church ladies who'd come along and began to wait, and every few minutes you'd inch forward and move your bag about the width of one suitcase, and little by little, as the light came on, the Eastern employees arrived. They began to process people who could get on a limited number of seats from an Eastern Airlines 727 that was coming to Montego Bay from Miami, filling up but leaving a certain number of seats and then coming on to Kingston. Little did we know the full story. After we'd been there for about 2 hours, hour and a half, whatever it was, we were told by a gentleman who came down the stairs that there were only 60 seats available on this one airliner that was going out. When Bronson and I got to the ticket window and checked in, they marked down that we were number 55 and 56. So there were just four people behind us that got on that flight. Or I might have been there till the next day, or maybe today, or maybe tomorrow, I don't know. But when we were in the line and inching forward, here came Mr. and Mrs. Herschel Fisher. And you know, all of our brethren down there are black people. You understand that. They're all black people. She provided us with special music the time we were there before, and we really enjoyed that. She walked up to us and asked if we wanted some orange juice. She knew that we hadn't eaten any breakfast. She had come all the way, I think by a bus or some other conveyance, maybe they hired a taxi, I don't know, with a carton of orange juice and a knife she'd brought from her own kitchen to carve it open, and with a couple of paper cups to give Bronson and I a little orange juice because she knew we hadn't had any breakfast. She was over there with her husband having tried to pound that roof back in shape and all their clothes and furniture soaked, and she's coming all the way across town, maybe 20, 30 miles, to give us a glass of orange juice. That's the kind of people your brethren are in Jamaica. And I think they're a fantastic example. If I ever find myself in a condition of terrible adversity, of a real disaster, I just as soon have a bunch of my Jamaican brethren around me as anybody else I know. So I hope that this church will join with me in helping them and showing them the same kind of love that they've shown us. Thank you all.